Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of The Uplift War by David Brin, narrated by George Wilson. As galactic armadas clash in quest of the ancient fleet of the progenitors, a brutal alien race seizes the dying planet of Garth. The various uplifted inhabitants of Garth must battle their overlords or face ultimate extinction. And now, the Uplift War.
Prelude. How strange that such an insignificant little world should come to matter so much. Traffic roared amid the towers of Capital City, just beyond the sealed crystal dome of the official palanquin. But no sound penetrated to disturb the bureaucrat of cost and caution, who concentrated only on the hollow image of a small planet turning slowly within reach of one down-covered arm. Blue seas and a jewel-bright spray of islands came into view as the bureaucrat watched, sparkling in the reflected glow of an out-of-view star. "If I were one of the gods spoken of in wolfling legends," the bureaucrat imagined. Its pinions flexed. There was the feeling one had only to reach out with a talon and seize. But no, the absurd idea demonstrated that the bureaucrat had spent too much time studying the enemy. Crazy Terran concepts were infecting its mind. Two downy aides fluttered quietly nearby, preening the bureaucrat's feathers and bright torque for the appointment ahead. They were ignored. Air cars and floater barges darted aside and regimented lanes of traffic melted away before the bright beacon of the official vehicle. This was status normally accorded only royalty. But within the palanquin all went on unnoticed as the bureaucrat's heavy beak lowered toward the hollow image. Garth. So many times the victim. The outlines of brown continents and shallow blue seas lay partly smeared under pinwheel storm clouds, as deceptively white and soft to the eye as a gubru's plumage. Along just one chain of islands, and at a single point at the edge of the largest continent, shone the lights of a few small cities. Everywhere else the world appeared untouched, perturbed only by occasional flickering strokes of storm-brewed lightning. Strings of code symbols told a darker truth. Garth was a poor place, a bad risk. Why else had the wolfling humans and their clients been granted a colony leasehold there? The place had been written off by the Galactic Institutes long ago. And now, unhappy little world, you have been chosen as a site for war. For practice, the bureaucrat of cost and caution thought in Anglic, the beastly unsanctioned language of the Earthling creatures. Most Gubru considered the study of alien things an unwholesome pastime. But now the bureaucrat's obsession seemed about to pay off at last. At last. Today. The palanquin had threaded past the great towers of Capital City, and a mammoth edifice of opalescent stone now seemed to rise just ahead. The Conclave Arena, seat of government of all of the Gubru race and clan. Nervous, anticipatory shivers flowed down the bureaucrat's headcrest, all the way to its vestigial flight feathers, bringing forth chirps of complaint from the two Kwaku aides. How could they finish preening the bureaucrat's fine white feathers, they asked, or buff its long hooked beak, if it didn't sit still? "I comprehend, understand, will comply," the bureaucrat answered indulgently, in standard galactic language number 3. These Kwaku were loyal creatures, to be allowed some minor impertinences. For distraction, the bureaucrat returned to thoughts of the small planet, Garth. "It is the most defenseless Earthling outpost, the one most easily taken hostage. That is why the military pushed for this operation, even while we are hard-pressed elsewhere in space. This will strike deeply at the Wolflings, and we may thereby coerce them to yield what we want. After the armed forces, the priesthood had been next to agree to the plan. Recently, the guardians of propriety had ruled that an invasion could be undertaken without any loss of honor. That left the civil service, the third leg of the perch of command. And there, consensus had broken. The bureaucrat superiors in the Department of Cost and Caution had demurred. The plan was too risky, they declared, too expensive. A perch cannot stand long on two legs. There must be consensus. There must be compromise. There are times when a nest cannot avoid taking risks. The mountainous conclave arena became a cliff of dressed stone covering half the sky. A cavernous opening loomed, then swallowed the palanquin. With a quiet murmur, the small vessel's gravitics shut down, and the canopy lifted. A crowd of Gubru in the normal white plumage of adult neuters already waited at the foot of the landing apron. They know, the bureaucrat thought, regarding them with its right eye. They know I am already no longer one of them. In its other eye, the bureaucrat caught a last glimpse of the white-swaddled blue globe. Garth. Soon, the bureaucrat thought in Anglic. We shall meet soon. The conclave arena was a riot of color, and such colors. Feathers shimmered everywhere in the royal hues, crimson, amber, and arsine blue. Two four-footed Kwaku servants opened a ceremonial portal for the bureaucrat of Cost and Caution, who momentarily had to stop and hiss in awe at the grandeur of the arena. Hundreds of perches lined the terraced walls, crafted in delicate, ornate beauty out of costly woods imported from 100 worlds. And all around, in regal splendor, stood the roostmasters of the Gubru race. No matter how well it had prepared for today, the bureaucrat could not help feeling deeply moved. Never had it seen so many queens and princes at one time. To an alien, there might seem little to distinguish the bureaucrat from its lords. All were tall, slender descendants of flightless birds. To the eye, only the roostmaster's striking colored plumage set them apart from the majority of the race. More important differences lay underneath, however. These, after all, were queens and princes, possessed of gender and the proven right to command. Nearby, roostmasters turned their sharp beaks aside in order to watch with one eye as the bureaucrat of Cost and Caution hurried through a quick, mincing dance of ritual abasement. Such colors! Love rose within the bureaucrat's downy breast, a hormonal surge triggered by those royal hues. It was an ancient, instinctive response, and no Gubru had ever proposed changing it, not even after they had learned the art of gene-altering and become starfarers. Those of the race who achieved the ultimate, color and gender, had to be worshipped and obeyed by those who were still white and neuter. It was the very heart of what it meant to be Gubru. It was good. It was the way. The bureaucrat noticed that two other white-plumed Gubru had also entered the arena through neighboring doors. They joined the bureaucrat upon the central platform. Together, the three of them took low perches facing the assembled roostmasters. The one on the right was draped in a silvery robe and bore around its narrow white throat the striped torque of priesthood. The candidate on the left wore the sidearm and steel talon guards of a military officer. The tips of its crest feathers were dyed to show the rank of stoop colonel. Aloof, the other two white-plumed Gubru did not turn to acknowledge the bureaucrat, nor did the bureaucrat offer any sign of recognizing them. Nevertheless, it felt a thrill. We are three. The president of the conclave, an aged queen whose once fiery plumage had now faded to a pale pinkish wash, fluffed her feathers and opened her beak. The arena's acoustics automatically amplified her voice as she chirped for attention. On all sides, the other queens and princes fell silent. The conclave president raised one slender, down-covered arm. Then she began to croon and sway. One by one, the other roost masters joined in, and soon the crowd of blue, amber, and crimson forms was rocking with her. From the royal assemblage, there rose a low, atonal moaning. Zoon. Since time immemorial, the president chirped in formal Galactic Three, since before our glory, since before our patronhood, since before even our uplift into sentience, it has been our way to seek balance. The assembly chanted in counter-rhythm. Balance on the ground's brown seams, balance in the rough air streams, balance in our greatest schemes. Back when our ancestors were still pre-sentient beasts, back before our Guxiu patrons found us and uplifted us to knowledge, back before we even spoke or knew tools, we had already learned this wisdom, this way of coming to decision, this way of coming to consensus, this way of making love. Zoom. As half-animals, our ancestors still knew that we must choose three. One to hunt and strike with daring, for glory and for territory. One to seek the righteous bearing, for purity and propriety. One to warn of danger looming, for our eggs' security. The bureaucrat of cost and caution sensed the other two candidates on either side and knew they were just as electrically aware, just as caught up in tense expectation. There was no greater honor than to be chosen as the three of them had been. Of course, all young Gubru were taught that this way was best, for what other species so beautifully combined politics and philosophy with lovemaking and reproduction? The system had served their race and clan well for ages. It had brought them to the heights of power in galactic society. And now it may have brought us to the brink of ruin. Perhaps it was sacrilegious even to imagine it, but the bureaucrat of cost and caution could not help wondering if one of the other methods it had studied might not be better after all. It had read of so many styles of government used by other races and clans, autarchies and aristocracies, technocracies and democracies, syndicates and meritocracies. Might not one of those actually be a better way of judging the right path in a dangerous universe? The idea might be irreverent. But such unconventional thinking was the reason certain roostmasters had singled out the bureaucrat for a role of destiny. Over the days and months ahead, someone among the three would have to be the doubting one. That was ever the role of cost and caution. In this way, we strike a balance. In this way, we seek consensus. In this way we resolve conflict. Zoon, agreed the gathered queens and princes. Much negotiation had gone into selecting each of the candidates, one from the military, one from the priestly orders, and one from the civil service. If all worked out well, a new queen and two new princes would emerge from the molting ahead. And along with a vital new line of eggs for the race, would also come a new policy, one arising out of the merging of their views. That was how it was supposed to end. The beginning, however, was another matter. Fated eventually to be lovers, the three would from the start also be competitors, adversaries, for there could be only one queen. We send forth this trio on a vital mission, a mission of conquest, a mission of coercion. We send them also in search of unity, in search of agreement, in search of consensus, to unite us in these troubled times. Zoon! In the eager chorus could be felt the conclave's desperate wish for resolution, for an end to bitter disagreements. The three candidates were to lead just one of many battle forces sent forth by the clan of the Guxiu Gubru. But clearly the Roostmasters had special hopes for this triumvirate. Quacku servitors offered shining goblets to each candidate. The bureaucrat of cost and caution lifted one and drank deeply. The fluid felt like golden fire going down. First taste of the royal liquor. As expected, it had a flavor like nothing else imaginable. Already the three candidates' white plumage seemed to glisten with a shimmering promise of color to come. We shall struggle together, and eventually, one of us shall molt amber, one shall molt blue. And one, presumably the strongest, the one with the best policy, would win the ultimate prize. A prize fated to be mine. For it was said to have all been arranged in advance. Caution had to win the upcoming consensus. Careful analysis had shown that the alternatives would be unbearable. You shall go forth, then, the conclave president sang. You three new suzerains of our race and of our clan, you shall go forth and win conquest. You shall go forth and humble the wolfling heretics. Zoon! The assembly cheered. The president's beak lowered toward her breast, as if she were suddenly exhausted. Then the new suzerain of cost and caution faintly heard her add, You shall go forth and try your best to save us. Part 1. Invasion. Let them uplift us shoulder high, then we will see over their heads to the several promised lands from which we have come and to which we trust to go. W. B. Yeats. Chapter 1. Pibin. There had never been such traffic at Port Helena's sleepy landing field. Not in all the years Pibin Bulger had lived here. The mesa overlooking Aspinall Bay reverberated with the numbing, infrasonic growl of engines. Dust plumes obscured the launching pits, but that did not prevent spectators from gathering along the peripheral fence to watch all the excitement. Those with a touch of psi talent could tell whenever a starship was about to lift off. Waves of muzzy uncertainty, caused by leaky gravitics, made a few onlookers blink quickly moments before another great strutted spacecraft rose above the haze and lumbered off into the cloud-dappled sky. The noise and stinging dust frayed tempers. It was even worse for those standing out on the tarmac, and especially bad for those forced to be there against their will. Pibin, certainly, would much rather have been just about anywhere else, preferably in a pub, applying pints of liquid anesthetic. But that was not to be. He observed the frenetic activity cynically. We're a sinking ship, he thought. And all the rats are saying adieu. Everything able to space and warp was departing Garth in indecent haste. Soon the landing field would be all but empty. Until the enemy arrives, whoever it turns out to be.
Psst, Fibbin, quit fidgeting.
Fibbin glanced to his right. The Chim standing next to him in formation looked nearly as uncomfortable as Fibbin felt. Simon Levin's dress uniform cap was turning dark just above his bony eye ridges, where damp brown fur curled under the rim. With his eyes, Simon mutely urged Fibbin to straighten up and look forward. Fibbin sighed. He knew he should try to stand at attention. The ceremony for the departing dignitary was nearly over, and a member of the Planetary Honor Guard wasn't supposed to slouch. But his gaze kept drifting over toward the southern end of the mesa, far from the commercial terminal and the departing freighters. Over there, uncamouflaged, lay an uneven row of drab black cigar shapes with the blocky look of fighting craft. Several of the small scout boats shimmered as technicians crawled over them, tuning their detectors and shields for the coming battle. Fibbin wondered if command had already decided which craft he was to fly. Perhaps they would let the half-trained colonial militia pilots draw lots to see who would get the most decrepit of the ancient war machines, recently purchased cut rate off a passing Zatini scrap dealer. With his left hand, Fibbin tugged at the stiff collar of his uniform and scratched the thick hair below his collarbone. "Old ain't necessarily bad," he reminded himself. "Go into battle aboard a thousand-year-old tub, and at least you know it can take punishment." Most of those battered scout boats had seen action out on the star lanes before human beings ever heard of galactic civilization, before they had even begun playing with gunpowder rockets, singeing their fingers and scaring the birds back on homeworld Earth. The image made Fibbin smile briefly. It wasn't the most respectful thing to think about one's patron race. But then humans hadn't exactly brought his people up to be reverent.
"Geez, this monkey suit itches. Naked apes like humans may be able to take this, but we hairy types just aren't built to wear this much clothing."
At least the ceremony for the departing Cynthian consul seemed to be nearing completion. Suoyo Suchuhuan, that pompous ball of fur and whiskers, was finishing her speech of farewell to the tenants of Garth Planet, the humans and Chims she was leaving to their fate. Fibbin scratched his chin again, wishing the little windbag would just climb into her launch and get the hell out of here, if she was in such a hurry to be going. An elbow jabbed him in the ribs. Simon muttered urgently,
"Straighten up, Fibbin. Her nibs is looking this way."
Over among the dignitaries, Megan Oneagle, the gray-haired planetary coordinator, pursed her lips and gave Fibbin a quick shake of her head.
"Aw, hell," he thought.
Megan's son, Robert, had been a classmate of Fibbin's at Garth's small university. Fibbin arched an eyebrow as if to say to the human administrator that he hadn't asked to serve on this dubious honor guard. And anyway, if humans had wanted clients who didn't scratch themselves, they never should have uplifted chimpanzees. He fixed his collar, though, and tried to straighten his posture. Form was nearly everything to these galactics, and Fibbin knew that even a lowly neo-chimp had to play his part, or the clan of Earth might lose face. On either side of Coordinator Oneagle stood the other dignitaries who had come to see Suoyo Shochuhun off. To Megan's left was Kalt, the hulking Thenanin envoy, leathery and resplendent in his brilliant cape and towering ridge crest. The breathing slits in his throat opened and closed like louvered blinds each time the big-jawed creature inhaled. To Megan's right stood a much more humanoid figure, slender and long-limbed, who slouched slightly, almost insouciantly in the afternoon sunshine.
"Uther Calving's amused by something,"
Fibbin could tell.
"So what else is new?"
Of course, Ambassador Uther Calding thought everything was funny. In his posture and the gently waving, silvery tendrils that floated above his small ears, and in the glint in his golden, wide-cast eyes, the pale Tim Brimmy, envoy, seemed to say what could not be spoken aloud. Something just short of insulting to the departing Scythian diplomat. Swovio Shochuhun sleeked back her whiskers before stepping forward to say farewell to each of her colleagues in turn. Watching her make ornate formal paw motions in front of Kalt, Fibbin was struck by how much she resembled a large, rotund raccoon, dressed up like some ancient Oriental courtier. Kalt, the huge Thenanin, puffed up his crest as he bowed in response. The two uneven-sized galactics exchanged pleasantries in fluting, highly inflected Galactic Six. Fibbin knew that there was little love to be lost between them.
"Well, you can't choose your friends, can you?" Simon whispered. "Damn right," Fibbin agreed.
It was ironic. The furry, canny Scythians were among Earth's few allies in the political and military quagmire of the five galaxies, but they were also fantastically self-centered and famous cowards. Swoio's departure as much as guaranteed there would be no armadas of fat, furry warriors coming to Garth's aid in her hour of need.
"Just like there won't be any help from Earth, nor Timbrim, them having enough problems of their own right now."
Fibbin understood Gal 6 well enough to follow some of what the big Thenanin said to Swario. Kalt apparently did not think much of ambassadors who skip out on their posts.
"Give the Thenanin that much," Fibbin thought.
Kalt's folk might be fanatics. Certainly they were listed among Earth's present official enemies. Nevertheless, they were known everywhere for their courage and severe sense of honor.
"No, you can't always choose your friends or your enemies."
Swoio stepped over to face Megan Oneagle. The Scythian's bow was marginally shallower than the one she had given Kalt. After all, humans ranked pretty low among the patron races of the galaxy.
"And you know what that makes you,"
Fibbin reminded himself. Megan bowed in return.
"I am sorry to see you go,"
she told Swoio in thickly accented Gal 6.
"Please pass on to your people our gratitude for their good wishes."
"Right," Fibbin muttered. "Tell all the other raccoons thanks a whole bunch."
He wore a blank expression, though. When Colonel Maven, the human commander of the Honor Guard, looked sharply his way. Swoio's reply was filled with platitudes. "Be patient," she urged. "The five galaxies are in turmoil right now. The fanatics among the great powers are causing so much trouble because they think the millennium, the end of a great era, is at hand. They are the first to act. Meanwhile, the moderates and the galactic institutes must move slower, more judiciously. But act they would," she assured, "in due time. Little Garth would not be forgotten."
"Sure," Fibbin thought sarcastically. "Why, help might be no more than a century or two away."
The other chims in the Honor Guard glanced at one another and rolled their eyes in disgust. The human officers were more reserved, but Fibbin saw that one was rotating his tongue firmly in his cheek. Swoio stopped at last before the senior member of the diplomatic corps, Uther Calding, Manfriend, the consul ambassador from the Timbrimi. The tall E.T. wore a loose black robe that offset his pale skin. Uther Calding's mouth was small, and the unearthly separation between his shadowed eyes seemed very wide. Nevertheless, the humanoid impression was quite strong. It always seemed to Fibbin as if the representative of Earth's greatest ally was always on the verge of laughing at some joke, great or small. Uther Calling, with his narrow scalp ruff of soft brown fur bordered by waving delicate tendrils, with his long delicate hands and ready humor, was the solitary being on this mesa who seemed untouched by the tension of the day.
The Timbrimi's ironic smile affected Fibbon, momentarily lifting his spirits.
"Finally!" Fibbon sighed in relief.
Swoio appeared to be finished at last. She turned and strode up the ramp toward her waiting launch. With a sharp command, Colonel Maven brought the guard to attention. Fibbon started mentally counting the number of steps to shade and a cool drink. But it was too soon to relax. Fibbon wasn't the only one to groan low as the Cynthian turned at the top of the ramp to address the onlookers one more time. Just what occurred then, and in exactly what order, would perplex Fibbon for a long time afterward. But it appeared that just as the first fluting tones of Gal 6 left Swoio's mouth, something bizarre happened across the landing field. Fibbon felt a scratchiness at the back of his eyeballs and glanced to the left, just in time to see a lambency shimmer around one of the scout boats. Then the tiny craft seemed to explode. He did not recall diving to the tarmac, but that's where he found himself next, trying to burrow into the tough, rubbery surface. What was it? An enemy attack so soon? He heard Simon snort violently. Then a chorus of sneezes followed. Blinking away dust, Fibbon peered and saw that the little scout craft still existed. It hadn't blown up after all. But its fields were out of control. They coruscated in a deafening, blinding display of light and sound. Shield-suited engineers scurried to shut down the boat's malfunctioning probability generator. But not before the noisome display had run everyone nearby through all the senses they had, from touch and taste all the way to smell and sigh.
"Ooh-wee!"
the chimney to Fibbon's left whistled, holding her nose uselessly.
"Who set off a stink bomb?"
In a flash, Fibbon knew, with uncanny certainty, that she had called it right. He rolled over quickly in time to see the Cynthian ambassador, her nose wrinkled in disgust and whiskers curled in shame, scamper into her ship, abandoning all dignity. The hatch clanged shut. Someone found the right switch at last and cut off the horrible overload, leaving only a fierce aftertaste and a ringing in his ears. The members of the honor guard stood up, dusting themselves and muttering irritably. Some humans and chims still quivered, blinking and yawning vigorously. Only the stolid, oblivious Thenanin ambassador seemed unaffected. In fact, Kalt appeared perplexed over this unusual earthling behavior.
"A stink bomb,"
Fibbon nodded.
"It was somebody's idea of a practical joke. And I think I know whose."
Fibbon looked closely at Uther Calding. He stared at the being who had been named Man-Friend, and recalled how the slender Timbrimi had smiled as Swoio, the pompous little Cynthian, launched into her final speech. Yes, Fibbon would be willing to swear on a copy of Darwin that at that very moment, just before the scout boat malfunctioned, Uther Calling's crown of silvery tendrils had lifted, and the ambassador had smiled, as if in delicious anticipation. Fibbon shook his head. For all their renowned psychic senses, no Timbrimi could have caused such an accident by sheer force of will. Not unless it had been arranged in advance, that is. The Cynthian launch rose upward on a blast of air and skimmed out across the field to a safe distance. Then, in a high whine of gravitics, the glittering craft swept upward to meet the clouds. At Colonel Maven's command, the honor guard snapped to attention one last time.
The planetary coordinator and her two remaining envoys passed in review. It might have been his imagination, but Fibbon felt sure that for an instant Uther Kalving slowed right in front of him. Fibbon was certain one of those wide silver-rimmed eyes looked directly at him, and the other one winked. Fibbon sighed. "Very funny," he thought, hoping the Tim Brimmy emissary would pick up the sarcasm in his mind. "We all may be smoking dead meat in a week's time, and you're making with practical jokes. Very funny, Uther Kalving." Chapter 2 Athaklana. Tendrils wafted alongside her head, ungentle in their agitation. Athaklana let her frustration and anger fizz like static electricity at the tips of the silvery strands. Their ends waved as if of their own accord, like slender fingers, shaping her almost palpable resentment into something. Nearby, one of the humans awaiting an audience with the planetary coordinator sniffed the air and looked around, puzzled. He moved away from Athaklana without quite knowing why he felt uncomfortable all of a sudden. He was probably a natural, if primitive, empath. Some men and women were able vaguely to ken Tim Brimmy empathy glyphs, though few ever had the training to interpret anything more than vague emotions. Someone else also noticed what Athaklana was doing. Across the public room, standing amid a small crowd of humans, her father lifted his head suddenly. His own corona of tendrils remained smooth and undisturbed, but Uther Kalving cocked his head and turned slightly to regard her, his expression both quizzical and slightly amused. It might have been similar if a human parent had caught his daughter in the act of kicking the sofa or muttering to herself sullenly. The frustration at the core was very nearly the same, except that Athaklana expressed it through her Tim Brimmy aura rather than an outward tantrum. At her father's glance, she hurriedly drew back her waving tendrils and wiped away the ugly sense glyph she had been crafting overhead. That did not ease her resentment, however. In this crowd of Earthlings, it was hard to forget. Caricatures, was Athaklana's contemptuous thought, knowing full well it was both unkind and unfair. Of course Earthlings couldn't help being what they were, one of the strangest tribes to come upon the galactic scene in eons. But that did not mean she had to like them. It might have helped if they were more alien, less like hulking, narrow-eyed, awkward versions of Tim Brimmy, wildly varied in color and hairiness, eerily off in their body proportions, and so often dour and moody, they frequently left Athaklana feeling depressed after too long a time spent in their company. Another thought on becoming the daughter of a diplomat. She chided herself and tried to redirect her mind. After all, the humans could not be blamed for radiating their fear right now, with a war they hadn't chosen about to fall crushingly upon them. She watched her father laugh at something said by one of the Earthling officers, and wondered how he did it, how he bore it so well. "I'll never learn that easy, confident manner. I'll never be able to make him proud of me." Athaklana wished Uther Kalving would finish up with these Terrans, so she could speak to him alone. In a few minutes, Robert Onegle would arrive to pick her up, and she wanted to have one more try at persuading her father not to send her away with the young human.
"I can be useful. I know I can. I don't have to be coddled off into the mountains for safety like some child."
Quickly, she clamped down before another glyph of resentment could form above her head. She needed distraction, something to keep her mind occupied while she waited. Restraining her emotions, Athaklana stepped quietly toward two human officers standing nearby, heads lowered in earnest conversation. They were speaking Anglic,
the most commonly used earth tone.
Look,
the first one said.
All we really know is that one of Earth's survey ships stumbled onto something weird and totally unexpected out in one of those ancient star clusters on the galactic fringe.
But what was it? The other militiaman asked.
What did they find? You're in alien studies, Alice. Don't you have any idea what those poor dolphins uncovered that could stir up such a ruckus?
The female Earthman shrugged.
Search me. But it didn't take anything more than the hints in the Streaker's first beamed report to set the most fanatic clans in the five galaxies fighting each other at a level that hasn't been seen in mega-years. The latest dispatches say some of the skirmishes have gotten pretty damn rough. You saw how scared that Cynthian looked a week ago, before she decided to pull out.
The other man nodded gloomily. Neither human spoke for a long moment. Their tension was a thing which arched the space between them. Athaclina kenned it as a simple but dark glyph of uncertain dread.
"It's something big,"
the first officer said at last in a low voice.
"This may really be it."
Athaclina moved away when she sensed the humans begin to take notice of her. Since arriving here in Garth, she had been altering her normal body form, changing her figure and features to resemble more closely those of a human girl. Nevertheless, there were limits to what such manipulations could accomplish, even using Tim Bremmy body imagery methods. There was no way really to disguise who she was. If she had stayed, inevitably the humans would have asked her a Tim Bremmy's opinion of the current crisis, and she was loath to tell Earthlings that she really knew no more than they did. Athaclina found the situation bitterly ironic. Once again, the races of Earth were in the spotlight, as they had been ever since the notorious Sundiver affair 2 centuries ago. This time, an interstellar crisis had been sparked by the first starship ever put under command of Neo-Dolphins. Mankind's second client race was no more than 2 centuries old, younger even than the Neo-Chimpanzees. How the cetacean spacers would ever find a way out of the mess they had inadvertently created was anyone's guess. But the repercussions were already spreading halfway across the central galaxy, all the way to isolated colony worlds such as Garth. Athaclina, she whirled. Ulthe Calving stood at her elbow looking down at her with an air of benign concern.
Are you all right, daughter?
She felt so small in Ulthe Calving's presence. Athaclina couldn't help being intimidated, however gentle he always was. His art and discipline were so great that she hadn't even sensed his approach until he touched the sleeve of her robe. Even now, all that could be kenned from his complex aura was the whirling empathy glyph called Karaduo, a father's love.
Yes, father, I am fine.
Good. Are you all packed and ready for your expedition, then?
His words were in Anglic. She answered in Tim Brim dialect, Galactic 7.
Father, I do not wish to go into the mountains with Robert Oneagle.
Ulthe Calving frowned.
I had thought that you and Robert were friends.
Athaclena's nostrils flared in frustration.
Why was Ulthe Calving purposely misunderstanding her? He had to know that the son of the planetary coordinator was unobjectionable as a companion. Robert was as close to a friend as she had among the young humans of Port Helenia.
It is partly for Robert's sake that I urge you to reconsider, she told her father. He is shamed at being ordered to nursemaid me, as they say, while his comrades and classmates are all in the militia preparing for war, and I certainly cannot blame him for his resentment.
When Ulthe Calving started to speak, she hurried on.
Also, I do not wish to leave you, father. I reiterate my earlier arguments of logic. when I explained how I might be useful to you in the weeks ahead. And now I add to them this offering as well.